Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet directly to your earbuds. And today is no exception. In fact, I think today is one of those podcasts that really exemplifies our mission statement, because we say we want to bring people that are interesting, first and foremost. And J. Warner Wallace, my guest today, is definitely interesting. In fact, he wrote a book that I'll talk about in just a moment with the word interest in it. But J. Warner Wallace is a cold case homicide detective. He is a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. He's an adjunct professor of apologetics at Talbot School of Theology. And before I go any further with that, let me just say that this is a podcast that is devoted to apologetics. And apologetics is as significant today, perhaps more significant today than ever before. This is basic training for every Christian. It is necessary for the preservation of the faith once for all delivered to the saints. It is necessary for the cultural relevance of the church. Instead of merely pontificating dogmatic assertions, Christians are commanded in Scripture to provide defensible arguments, and then to do it with gentleness and with respect, and as J. Warner Wallace does, in a compelling fashion. One of the interesting things about my guest today is that his cases have been featured perhaps more than any other detective as a person and as a corpus of work on NBC's Dateline. His work has also appeared on Court TV, Fox News, and I could go on. He was awarded the Police and Fire Medal of Valor, and he is the author of many significant books, including Cold Case Christianity, God's Crime Scene, Forensic Faith, and the book that we want to talk about today, Person of Interest, Why Jesus Still Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible, a book in which J. Warner Wallace uncovers the truth about Jesus using the same approach he used to solve real murder cases. I want to read my endorsement of this book because I think it sort of codifies my excitement for a book that you need to read. And by the way, this book available to anyone that stands shoulder to shoulder with me in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy for your support on the web at equip.org. But here's what I say about this book. I say, with characteristic brilliance, cold case detective J. Warner Wallace, he demonstrates the reality and the relevance of Jesus to a skeptical post-Christian world. He fingers a Messiah whose ancestry was marked, whose birthplace foretold, the circumstances surrounding his death prophesied before, and this is an interesting point, before crucifixion was ever invented. The date of his visitation was predicted within historically narrow time parameters. An extraordinary worker of miracles who fulfilled the law and the prophets and a light to the Gentiles so that salvation would go out to the ends of the earth. Moreover, as demonstrated by J. Warner Wallace, from credible external witnesses, it is possible to piece together highlights of the life and passion of the Christ, wholly apart from Scripture. Person of Interest is a masterpiece of intrigue, identifying Jesus as the quintessential person of history. So this is a very important book. As I've mentioned in this introduction, apologetics is a very important discipline. It is not simply a discipline for professionals. It is something that every single Christian needs to become proficient at. And it is not only a very important technique for pre-evangelism, God using your well-reasoned answer as a springboard or an opportunity for sharing the truth and life and grace that only Jesus Christ can bring to the human heart, but it's also post-evangelism. And what I mean by that is when the winds of doubt and the winds of despair begin to crash upon your house of faith, there are pillars and posts that you can hang on to. You can know that God created the universe, that Jesus Christ is God, and that the Bible is, in fact, divine, as opposed to being merely human in origin. Well, much more could be said, but Person of Interest is a book that you need to read. It's a book that is illustrated by J. Warner Wallace himself. And with that, welcome to the podcast.
Wow, thanks so much for having me. You know your own role in all that. You're absolutely right about it being a pre-evangelism. I mean, we talk about sometimes, Hank, we talk about how, you know, as an evangelism strategy or an approach, I hear so many people who would say, well, you know, what you just need to do is you just need to be more like Jesus. You need to model Jesus for people around you. And that's, you know, the best testimony you're ever going to have is your own personal testimony of your life. And all that's true. But a lot of that, you know, if that's the case, and it's, well, then we should all become Mormons, I guess, because it seems to me that people who are in a works-based system are far more likely to work hard and look great. And so their testimony of their lived lives are usually powerful. But for me, it was testimony of your lived life that was powerful. I told you when I first was examining all of this evidence, the stuff I write about in this book as well, you know, I was stuck in a surveillance vehicle because I was working on a surveillance team, and I was stuck without any media back in those days. All you had was your AM and FM radio, right? So I remember I would, every day at 3 o'clock in Los Angeles, the Bible Answer Man would come on. And yes, it was the facts, the defense of the gospel, that was really important. It was, I mean, I was listening to that, kind of, you know, weighing the options, weighing all the evidence. But also it was this idea of modeling an intelligent, thoughtful, interactive faith, because I wasn't seeing that in the people who I was meeting on the job who were, say they were Christians, even though they were good case makers as detectives. And I knew a couple. They weren't good defenders of their Christian beliefs to the point where it was like, well, you know, really? I'm surprised that they can't do this better. Like, they don't have the same value for making a case in their spiritual life that they would have in their material life, right? So you provided for me an example of, okay, this is what this looks like. If you are thoughtful, if you do consider evidence important, this is what this looks and sounds like. And that, I think, is an important part of the evangelism process as well.
Yeah, I want to get back to you sitting in a squad car, you being a cold case detective, and at the same time, someone who's an atheist, who finally ends up in a church. You hear someone say that Jesus is the most important person in history, the smartest person in history, and so forth. And that intrigued you to the point of examining who Jesus Christ is, examining whether the Bible really has relevance in an age of scientific enlightenment.
Yeah, it did. Because I think, you know, prideful people are often prideful enough to think that they're smart. And when someone provokes you and says, well, you know, there's somebody out there who's smarter than you, you think, well, really? I mean, just kind of, I was very interested in the fortune cookie version of Jesus. The same way, when I was in high school, I had a sociology teacher who was a very active Baha'i. And he said, you know, Baha'u'llah wrote a lot of really interesting things. He's a really smart guy. You should read his writings. So, yeah, I bought it. I didn't think anything of it. I just ignored the claims to being the manifestation of God. I ignored all that. I was just looking to mine out, like, what are the, look, if you've got an ancient sage whose wisdom has survived the ages, then probably there's something in this that, just from an evolutionary process, would be worth looking at, right? Because this is wisdom that has survived this evolutionary process I thought we were all on. So I was interested in Jesus that way. Like, what's so smart about Jesus? And, hey, you know, and as you read through this, you think, wow, you know, there's a lot of cultural expressions that seem to have been rooted in the teaching of Jesus. And so you can kind of see, okay, fine. But then I became more and more engaged in the nature of the narrative. So I'm reading through the narratives to mine out the red letters. And then I'm realizing, you know, this is actually has the texture, especially when I saw what people would typically today call a contradiction. I knew better than that. I knew that eyewitness testimony always has some level of variation between each account. And there, I saw that in the Gospels, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to test these and see if they hold up. That's what really started the whole process. But yeah, it started with you know, what's in it for me? Well, the wisdom of Jesus is in it for me, so I'm willing to look at this only because, you know, I was prideful and selfish enough that that intrigued me.
I kind of want to let the audience know what a cold case detective is. Maybe there are a lot of people listening in that really don't know what that describes.
So basically, you know, not every case can go cold because most cases will close after a certain number of years because it seems like it's too prejudicial against a potential suspect if we let this thing stay open for 25 years. How are you going to find your own witnesses to defend yourself? So almost every crime has what they call a statute of limitations. You know, if it's a burglary or a robbery or property crimes, even some lower level assaults. But when you get to murder, those things don't have a statute of limitations. So when those don't get solved, you know, they go cold, they still are available to work. And usually you have families who always want to know what happened to my sister, you know, what happened to my mom. So you have usually interest from the family that keeps them calling you. And I had a bunch of these. I was working robbery homicide, and we were at some point, we got a new sergeant who was very ambitious. He said, you know, we should try to solve some of these cold cases. And all of us on the team were like, really? You know, we're bombed with all the fresh cases. Do we really want to add something that everyone's forgotten about 25 years ago? Can we just let that be? And let's just work on the ones. We don't want these to go cold, do we? So I was hesitant. We were assigned these as collateral duties. And so I got these old cases, and they would sit around. And they sat around for about 3 years. And no one really, our five-man team, ever really advanced his or her homicide cold case because we were, like, still busy with the fresh cases. And then I got injured, and I had a downtime of about 8 months. So I was light duty, and they weren't assigning me cases. So I picked up a cold case, the one that was not my cold case. I had one that was assigned to me, but my partner had one I thought was better. So that was the first one I solved. And then that started an avalanche of our department realizing, wow, you know, if we devoted – and, of course, that first case went on Dateline right away. And so then we were – now the department thinks to itself, really? So these cases are grabbing national attention. They allowed me to form a team. So I had that team until I retired. I just basically worked every cold case I could find in our agency, and there were a bunch of them, about 30, and we didn't get through all of them. Then I've got a couple that are still open, but we got through a lot of them, and those things all ended up on Dateline.
Before we get into the actual essence of the book, I want to talk about the construction of the book. I think this is really important, because what you have done is you have woven together something that's happening in the contemporary world with something that's happening in the ancient world. Then on top of that, I guess you're an artist because you have, from what I hear, produced every one of the pictures that's in this book as well, or the illustrations. And there's a correspondence between your drawings and what you used to do as a cold case detective. So maybe you can give us a bit of an idea of what someone will get when they actually pick up this book, because it's unlike anything I've ever seen in apologetics.
Well, you know, a lot of it was I came out, my dad was a cop, and he was in the job for almost 30 years. And I was raised by my mom, though, so, you know, my dad was more like my uncle. And so I ended up kind of thinking I was going to be an artist and then thinking I was going to be an architect. And I did get a master's degree in architecture before I left the architectural firm I was working in and followed in my dad's footsteps. And there were a number of years early on in my police career where I was like, oh, I felt like frustrated. Like I was like, I didn't have that creative outlet. You know, I started a band with all police officers called Beyond the Law. You know, this ridiculous stuff, just trying to scratch that itch. And then when I started working cold cases, I realized that when you're in front of juries on complex, cumulative, circumstantial cases, you need to see how it connects. You need to see how this puzzles together visually. And there are a number of, you know, like parables that Jesus uses, right? He's trying to use word pictures so you get these larger concepts and you go, oh, yeah, this is like that. So I started doing the same kinds of things in our jury trials. And they became highly visual, and that most of my stage presentations today are just a reflection of what I would do in front of a jury. And that also helped me to kind of scratch that itch. So when I got to writing books, I always wanted to have a book that was really heavily illustrated. But I think when I first started, you know, the publishers are like, I don't know about this. And I said, well, I'll draw them. It won't cost anything more. I'm going to draw all of these things. So that's what I did here. We have over 400 illustrations in this book. And a lot of what we did here, Hank, is we learned from our kids' books. The ratio, and when you do kids' books, you want the ratio of text to image to be about 50-50. And even for like young teens, like 8 to 12-year-olds, those kids really are highly visual now, and they always have been. So I want that ratio to be 50-50. So when I got to do this book, I told Susie, my wife, I said, you know, this is going to be like a kid's book for adults. I don't want a single, unless there's a list, right, that's taking up space on the page, I want every page to have some graphic element. Well, with 400 illustrations on a book that's about, 300 pages, you know, you've got several pages where there are two illustrations on the page. But the idea here is, I asked Zondervan, the publisher, will you give me 2 years to build this stage presentation and present to groups? Because you learn about what works and what doesn't work in front of a jury by making mistakes. Like, this is visually powerful in my mind. This is going to be great, the sequence. And I would spend like 2 weeks building the sequence. It's only going to take like 5 seconds, right? And I click through it all and go, you know what? It's not that great. So I would just scrap it. And so after doing that for 2 years, and COVID certainly helped, I was able to go back then. Oh, now here's a problem. Now you're writing a book from your media presentations. And that means you're going to have a lot of illustrations. And so we knew that's going to be the nature of this book. So this book is, you know, it traces a cold case every chapter. It's kind of got graphic elements in every chapter, and it's got my personal story in it in every chapter, but it also has, of course, the case for Jesus from the fuse and the fallout.
You know, what's really interesting about this, and maybe you can elaborate a little more on this, but what you're doing here is you're presenting a mystery. So as you start to read this mystery, a cold case being solved, the analogy is made to the cold case being solved with respect to Messiah. So you have two cold cases interwoven in the construction of the book. One is about a person of interest named Steve, and the other by an ancient person of interest who is our Savior.
Yeah, and you know, there's a risk here, Hank. There's a risk any time you're being creative that you'll get out over your skis. And I worried about that a little bit, too. So I know that there's a genre of books out there and how most people would write a book like this. I actually read a bunch of those books. You know, what impact did Jesus have on history? And all these books are great. And I'm reading through all of them. But I'm looking, I'm saying, hey, I want something that is going to be powerful in front. Like, I've been on cases with jurors where I'm watching the jury the entire trial while the prosecution and the defense are going back and forth. And my concern is, are they bored? Are they so bored and so fed up with the players in this case that they're willing to not make the right proper decision because they're just angry that they had to sit through this for 6 weeks? And so I'm always concerned about, is it engaging? You know, are we accomplishing the goal of teaching about all the evidence, but at the same time, we have them so engaged that they're going to go back, talk about it once, vote once, and come out with a verdict? And that's what we're looking for, right? So that's always the challenge. And so at this kind of a book, I think it takes risks in that sense. And it tries to be, you know, three things at once. And, of course, there's always a risk you won't do any of those well. So that's why, you know, I'm glad we're done now, and I think people are receiving it well. And so, but it is creative in the sense that we took some risks.
And it was done very, very well. What exactly is a person of interest? That's your title.
So a person of interest, you know, there's a movie out, there's a television series. It's not like I'm stealing a term. This is a term that's often used in criminal investigations, and it usually means that there's somebody out there that you're not quite sure, but probably might be somebody involved in this case in a negative way. But it can also just be a witness, a critical witness, somebody who's like, hey, this is a person of interest because this person was seen, should have information for us, blah, blah, blah. We're not saying that's the suspect, but we're saying this is somebody who's critical to our investigation. But most of the time when people use this, you often see it used to mean, okay, we think he's our suspect, but we're not quite there yet evidentially, so we're just going to call him a person of interest before we finally call him our suspect. But in the end, it usually is somebody who's the focus of an investigation.
And Jesus is the focus of your investigation. Talk a little bit about your own journey. You started out as an atheist. You went to a church. You heard someone say that, or a pastor say that Jesus was the smartest person in history, and that starts an entire trek for you.
Yeah, it did. And it's not like I was, you know, I've got a good friend, your friend as well, Lee Strobel, who's done a bunch of these books on Case 4, and his wife Leslie got saved, and then he was kind of like trying to dissuade her, you know, like, this isn't true, you know, this is a waste of your time. That was not my position. I was more than look, Susie was not a believer. So we went because she thought, well, we should probably, like, shouldn't we? And we had been together 18 years. This conversation only came up maybe in the last couple of years before we started going to church. And it was, hey, should we raise our kids with some form of spiritual belief system in place? I mean, especially when you're starting to teach your kids about life and about what's right and what's wrong. And I thought, no. Look, I wasn't raised this way. You weren't raised this. Why do we have to do this now? I mean, to me, it was necessary. I thought you could learn, because this is me also, of course, being prideful and thinking I'm the best and like I can do this on my own. But I just thought it was unnecessary. And I thought it was ridiculous in the sense that, like, I wasn't trying to prove Christianity wrong. Like, who reads Peter Pan and tries to prove Peter Pan wrong? I mean, you might get something out of Peter Pan. I don't know, but I don't need to prove it wrong. It's stupid. It's nonsensical. It's false on its face. I don't need to prove it wrong. That's how I honestly felt. But I was willing to go because my dad has been doing this his whole life. He thinks that he doesn't care what you believe, as long as you believe something about God, because it's a useful falsehood that will make better people. He would much rather live in a country with people who believe in God than in a country that doesn't believe in God, although he doesn't believe in God. You know, he would say he's not. I think he's starting to move as he's getting older, but for most of his life, he would say that was not him. So he was willing to go. He'd be willing to go with you. Look, when I, years later, became a pastor and I had my own church, he came out one summer and he was there for 2 weeks. So he was in two church services over the weekend, and we went to this service project, and he went with us to do the service project. He's in favor. I was the same way. I'll go. It's not true. Don't care if it is. You don't need to convince me. I'm more than happy to go if you want to go. And that was my view. So that's how I ended up sitting in this church. And I, just because he provoked me, I just thought, well, if I'm going to be sitting here, I might as well figure out what this guy thinks he's so smart. And the guy who said this, too, was just regular enough to impress me, you know? I mean, he didn't seem religious, quote unquote. He just seemed like a guy talking about Jesus. And that's, I think, what kind of just hit me in a way that was pretty neutral. Like, he wasn't so dogmatic where he was making these dogmatic claims. He just was said it like he was talking about it's nice weather today, and Jesus is the smartest man who ever lived. So I thought, okay, let's see if that's true. And that's what started. I bought a Pew Bible. It's sitting right behind me on my shelf here. I didn't spend a lot of money on it, and it's fallen apart now, but I've just had it. I just kept it. This is the first Bible I ever owned. And, you know, I did forensic statement analysis on all the Gospels, and so all that stuff, all those notes are still in there, and that's really was the path that led me to where I'm writing these kinds of books. I never, ever, Hank, ever thought that I would write books. Never. This just all just happened organically, so.
It's just amazing. Your story is an amazing story, and I think one of the keys to the book is that you make plain that someone can make a case for the historicity and deity of Jesus Christ without any evidence whatsoever from the Bible. In other words, you can demonstrate something about Jesus Christ through all kinds of other evidence that is available, and we'll talk about all of that, but that's, I think, such a noteworthy statement in and of itself, that you can prove that Jesus Christ is a historical being, and you can even see the deity of Jesus Christ apart from the New Testament, as opposed to just seeing it within the context of the New Testament.
That's right, because I was one of those guys who I would have said, I don't really trust. I mean, if you're going to have me read this, again, I was just reading it as a piece of what I consider to be fiction, that I could mine out truths from fiction. You've seen this before, right? You've seen there are fictional books that are out there. As a matter of fact, in one of the chapters, talk about all the Christ figures that are written into fiction, where you can mine out principles, biblical principles, from fiction. So I thought, well, it's fiction, but I'm more than happy to mine out the truth in the fiction. And that's really what started all of it. And I was not willing to, you know, when you first start, like, it took me 8 months to go through forensically the Gospels. I needed a quicker way in. I needed to know. And so, again, it comes down to that model that I used in the book called The Fuse and the Fallout. That's a way that you don't have to trust anything about Scripture to use that investigative model to learn something about Jesus.
What about this notion that Jesus is just a copycat, that you can find the basic contours of Jesus through mythology? In other words, the mythologies, the ancient mythologies, employ biblical language, and then they go to great lengths to concoct commonalities. And so this is what is happening with respect to Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of ways of looking at that. You know, I remember studying this stuff, what now, 25 years ago, when I first started studying Jesus, and I talk about in this book. And years later, I was a youth pastor. And I forget who was the first. A movie came out called Zeitgeist. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Another movie called The God Who Wasn't There. And these two movies came out pretty close in the same time frame. And my students were like going, hey, I saw this movie. This is, you know, this is disturbing. And so I watched it right away, and I said, okay, this is vastly, grossly overstated. And I already knew from studying this stuff that it wasn't going to be a problem for me. But I knew then I had to shift and start to make this case for my students, because now they were being presented with the thing we talked about, which is the strength of visual presentations. And these videos are crafted in such a way that they are visually compelling. And what they basically claim is, yeah, you know, that Jesus is just another dying and rising Savior who possesses all of the same attributes you find in all kinds of false mythologies. And Jesus is just another false mythology cobbled together from the prior false mythologies. And that's kind of the claim of these kinds of books and a bunch of stuff that's out there in book form and in movie form, you know, going back to Richard Carrier, all this stuff that's out there. And for me, I was like, well, have you really read the mythologies? Because I actually had. And so 2 years ago, we started reading through the mythologies again. But I wanted to do a more precise kind of list of what these mythologies have in common. And it was really hard because the first time reading through them, I might have found like six things. These six things are common to all. And then I'm about three quarters of the way through and I find a seventh thing. And I go, oh, the seventh thing, I'm starting to see it now. But where did I see it before? Like, I can't remember where I saw it. Now I have to go back and start to read the whole mythologies all over again. And sure enough, now I find an eighth thing. So you end up rereading these mythologies a bazillion times because you keep on finding little things. Now, some are not great, but some are. So I found 15 attributes that I list in the book that are common between ancient mythologies. I don't know if anyone's done that work. I wish I would have known because I would have just borrowed it. But to those 15 attributes, I'm seeing these things. They are very general, very broad. They are not specific things. And so they're illustrated in the book. It's hard to talk about a book that's so heavily illustrated. But once you see them on the wall, you kind of go, oh, okay. And it turns out that no mythology has more than about 10 of these 15 things. And even some have as few as 6. So somewhere, each mythology, and I went back in the timeline, and I looked at everything from South America all the way through, you know, the Persian gods, the Greek, the, you know, Asian gods. I mean, I just tried to get everything I could. And if you look at all those, you'll find that 6 to 10 of the 15 are shared by these deities. And they're so broad. So, for example, if like one of these is the deity appears in the world miraculously, unexpectedly. Well, okay, that could be anything from popping out of the side of a mountain, from coming out of a god's thigh, from being born of a virgin. These are things that you'll see that they're going to come into the world in an unexpected way. And I started to realize as I'm reading through these, this is like the common, if you were like dreaming up about God, you thought, well, creation sure looks like it's been created. Is there a God who would have created this? Well, if so, what kinds of characteristics would you imagine this God to possess? Well, there are 15. And, you know, popping into the world in an unusual way is not that surprising, it seems to me, as an expectation. They're very different, the different stories, but they do often come into the world. And I'll tell you one that all of them have in common is that all of these mythologies can work miracles. Well, duh. You know, if your God is God, he probably can work miracles. So, and the kinds of miracles they work are different, but they all have this supernatural power. Well, that's what you expect from God. So I made a list of the 15 ancient expectations of people groups that end up appearing as commonalities in their ancient mythologies, even though it only ranges like from 6 to 10. Well, then it turns out that Jesus appears on the scene, and he is the one, let's just call him a person for now because I didn't want to call him God, who actually possesses all 15. He's the only one who possesses all 15. He takes all the expectations of the ancients, and he manifests them in their totality. And I thought to myself, well, if there's a spiritual fuse that is burning up to the explosive appearance of Jesus, if God is going to enter into his creation, well, if he was intending to meet the expectations of ancients, of anyone, any people group on the planet, in the most robust way, he did it. Because in Jesus, every expectation of the ancients is met. And this is another piece of evidence from the fuse that I thought was important.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that Christianity borrowed from Greek mythology. And the people who purvey this kind of mythology, they typically employ biblical language, and then they go to great lengths to concoct commonalities. And one of the things I looked at early on in the same vein is parallels between the resurrection of Osiris and the resurrection of Christ. And if you look at it as a cold case detective, you find out that this is an obvious stretch. And the mysteries, that's about as good as it gets. The other thing that I've pointed out in the past, and I don't know what your opinion on this is, but it seems to me that most mystery religions flourish long after the closing of the canon of Scripture. And therefore, it would be more accurate to say that the mysteries were influenced by Christianity than the other way around.
No, absolutely. And that's what I tried to do in one of the chapters. So here's what I basically did. I said, okay, look, in any cold case where you don't have a body, and this happens on occasion, where a guy kills his partner or kills his wife, and then he gets rid of her body, and then he tells everybody, oh, yeah, she ran off last night. Oh, really? Where'd she go? I don't know. You know, she hasn't come back. We had an argument, and she never came back. And the first officers will take this as a missing person case, and then they don't even photograph the crime scene. They don't think there is a crime scene. And then, you know, 5 days later, she hasn't come back yet. But, you know, he's convinced the family it's normal, it's going to be okay, so they don't press. Well, then a month goes by, and you're behind the curve. And then sometimes 3, 4, 5 years go by before you're actually now working this as a homicide, and you've got no crime scene because you never took it as a murder. You took that case as a missing person. Well, how do you make a case in front of a jury when you've got no evidence from a crime scene? Well, I always tell people that on the day she disappeared, some explosive event took place if she was killed. And that means that in that crime scene, a bomb went off. And bombs are always preceded by fuses that burn slowly toward the detonation of the bomb. And after the bomb explodes, you've got shrapnel and all kinds of stuff everywhere. So I will make the case to the jury just from the fuse and the fallout. I'll show why that fuse that's burning up to her disappearance points to her killer, and I'll show you why all the fallout after the bomb explodes points to the killer. Doing the same thing here with Jesus. If you had no crime scene, no New Testament, get rid of that. Imagine every single one has been destroyed. All you have is the fuse of history leading up to that explosive moment when the Common Era begins. And all you have after that is the fallout of what happens in the Common Era. You can still determine what it is that changed all of history into the Common Era. And I always considered it to be the Common Era back then because I wasn't a believer. So I think when one of these fuses is this mythology fuse, and what you'll see, and this is why I quoted Lewis, because, of course, you know, Lewis, one of the most frustrating things you'll do as an author, and I know that you've done some of this too, is that people will quote my books, and they're usually quoting somebody that I quoted. Like, I'm being offered as the authority here, and it's almost always a C.S. Lewis quote, and I'm like, dang, this quote this guy saw in the book is not my quote. But this is one from a letter that he wrote to Arthur Greaves, and in it he says this. He says, now, the story of Christ is simply a true myth. Now, he's using the word myth here not to say as a, you know, a false story. He's using it as a narrative about deity. So he says the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference that it really happened. And one must be content to accept it in that way, remembering that it is God's myth, where the others are men's myths, i.e., the pagan stories are God expressing himself through the minds of poets, using such images as he found there, while Christianity is God expressing himself through what we call real things. And that is exactly what I see happening in history. The stage has been set. So if you wanted to appear on the planet at a time when the most number of people groups are worshiping deities from their imagination, right? These are the myths of the pagans, but they have these commonalities. Well, these things don't last forever. There's a start time of worship and an end time of worship for each of these mythologies, and I have it illustrated in the book so you can see it. You will see that there is an opportunity, a window of opportunity, in which if you arrive right here in history, you're actually going to be in a position where people have expectations you could meet. And that is something that I think is important, right? So it's just one aspect of the fuse that I think is burning up to this window. I call this the red zone, which is just that zone where you have opportunities. You know, in a criminal case, the red zone would be like, okay, I need to assemble all my weapons, and I'm going to dispose of her body this way. I got to get that stuff together first, so I can't really do this until I have these minimal conditions met. And then I got this deadline. I got to do it before she leaves town, so I've got to work between that window of opportunity, I call the red zone, between having everything I need to do the job and before she gets out of town. That little window of opportunity tells me who did this, because every window is dictated by a suspect in his behavior. And so here we have a window of opportunity that is dictated by people groups that are worshiping gods with certain commonalities, and the overlap of their times of worship is exactly where Jesus appears.
Yeah, I think that bears elaboration. I mean, here you have Jesus coming at exactly the right time in history, what the Bible describes as the fullness of time. Yeah. There are so many things going on, including the Pax Romana, yeah. many things going on that make this the absolute perfect time in history.
Absolutely. What I tried to do is to show in one of the chapters how we build red zones in criminal cases, in the case, in fact, that we're talking about in the book. And so I showed this red zone, and you can see that the red zone alone would have pointed me toward Tammy's killer, because red zones are charted based on the behaviors of victims and potential suspects. And every suspect you look at will have its own set of conditions that will change your red zone. So you'll see that some of these suspects don't even have a red zone in which the murder occurred. Then when you find one does have a red zone where the murder occurred, you're like going, oh, this could be our guy, because his red zone seems to line up. Well, I did the same thing, tracing both the prophecies of the Old Testament. And that's an area where you guys were so helpful to me. A lot of areas. I sent the early manuscript to you guys, and boy, you guys just really blessed me with helping me to articulate a lot of what we talk about in those chapters. But I traced the prophecy of the Jews, the spiritual expectations of the non-Jews, and the culture of the people groups that were allowing for certain modifications and inventions, really, of languages, of alphabets, of postal services, of just the history of when war is occurring and when it is not occurring. These are things that not only allowed for Jesus to be born in a part of the world where there was a peace, a window of peace, a red zone of peace, but also that happened to be the roads that Paul traveled to make Jesus known would not have been available to him before that red zone. And because those things came into existence, because for the most part, the Roman Empire was able, during this Pax Romana, this 200-year period of peace, to shift its priorities toward road construction, toward bridge construction, toward tunnel construction, the things that eventually led to the expression that all roads lead to Rome. So this is really one of the reasons why Jesus has the kind of amazing impact, is because history aligned in such a way. And when you see it visually, when you see the overlap of these three different kinds of fuses, and you see how tight the window of opportunity is, and then Jesus ends up right in the middle of it, you're thinking, okay, well, no wonder the Common Era was initiated here, because something is amazing about Jesus' appearance there that changed history.
There's so many ways that we can know about Jesus, as you make plain in the book. You can know about Jesus through Christians who were the followers or disciples of Jesus. You can know about Jesus through people who were non-Christians, but they loved the principles that Messiah brought into the world, although they didn't really honor him as Messiah. You can also, however, know about Jesus through non-Christians who absolutely despised him.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I try to kind of parallel this to the story of Elvis. Like, how many times have you heard the complaint? Well, tell me, if Jesus is really who he said he was, why would only four people write about him? Well, that's not actually true. You know, it turns out that Jesus had the kind of impact that nobody else in history had. And just to give you a kind of a parallel from my, I'm an old guy now, but if I, you know, I remember when Elvis died. And when he died, I was working at a small market, and I was out sweeping in the parking lot, and I heard on the radio that Elvis Presley had died. And, you know, I was probably a little bit too young to be an Elvis Presley fan, but my mom sure was, my dad sure was. And I thought, wow, you know, he had, it turned out that after Elvis died, literally a book has been written pretty much every single year, at least one, since he died. And in the first couple of years, you'd have like 8-9 books written a year, and they're written by different groups, like Presley's, people who were family members who liked Elvis, and you have them written by non-Presley's, strangers, but they also liked Elvis. And then you have a group of non-Presley's who disliked Elvis and would write bad things about these, and write, and a lot of these are written later in history, so they can write whatever they want because nobody is alive to contradict them anymore. So you saw those three groups in the Elvis story, and he has this huge literary impact. And I have a, you know, a list in the back of the book of all of the books written about Elvis. That's kind of a stupid thing to list, but the point is there's a ton. Now, Jesus had a similar impact on history in that there were people, Christians, who liked Jesus. And I'm only looking at the writers in the first 300 years, because that period of time when you're under persecution and intolerance and more persecution, then a little bit more tolerance and more persecution, you're not the religion of the empire. By the way, I get it, power can corrupt, but you don't have any power yet. So I'm looking at those Christians and those writers, both Christian and non-Christian, who lived and wrote prior to Christianity becoming the religion of the empire, prior to the Edict of Milan, prior to the Edict of Thessalonica. And if you look at those same three kinds of groups, you have Christians who like Jesus, you have non-Christians who like Jesus, and you have non-Christians who dislike Jesus, just like Elvis. Now, you can reconstruct the story of Elvis just from the different writings of Elvis, because they all, they're going to start to twist the story of Elvis, but they all begin with common concepts of the life and career of Elvis, and then they take all these rabbit trails and they distort the story of Elvis, but you can reconstruct the truth about Elvis just by looking at what's coming. Something similar happens here. You can look at these three groups and reconstruct the story of Jesus just from what's common. So you don't need the scriptures to do this. As a matter of fact, you'll see that in the book I have a diagram and I have an illustration of all of the people, both Christian and non-Christian sources, and it turns out that there are more non-Christian voices in the first 300 years who write or say something about Jesus than there are Christian voices. And when I say non-Christian, I mean like the non-canonical gospel authors. These are people who wrote late in history. They liked Jesus, but they weren't Christians by any stretch. And they wrote a lot of mythology about Jesus, taking his story and, you know, building on the basics that we see in the gospels and then twisting them so they became, you know, keepers of secrets and all kinds of different things. Those are non-Christian voices, but they are, for the most part, sympathetic to the Jesus story. And then you have Persian and Greek and Jewish and Egyptian voices in history who have a lot of negative things to say about Jesus, but they're basically assuming all the positives in order to offer the negatives. And so you could actually reconstruct the story of Jesus without any testament just from writers in the first 300 years.
There are so many things that seem to be self-evident, but somehow or other they elude us. And you point us back to these realities, one of which being that Jesus dominates the bookshelves, that there are more books written about Jesus than any other figure in the history of the human race.
That's right. And it's not even a close, you know, so this has been done a couple different ways. Years ago, a guy who was an ex-CIA intelligence officer did this through the Library of Congress. And so I made a list of his top books, you know, the top historical figures mentioned in the books in the Library of Congress, which is the largest standing library of physical books. And it's Jesus way out ahead, almost 2-1 to the next competitor in that list. Well, then, of course, you could also search on Google Books, because this takes you out of a library and puts you into the world of books online, including self-published books, including books in other lands. You know, as long as they've mentioned Jesus of Nazareth, they're on the list, and he's still out way out in front. So no matter how you slice this, Jesus has been fascinating to authors. That's why they have a category called Jesus Figures in Literature, in which, and I've got a whole list here in the book, of the kinds of fictional characters that borrow from the outline of the Jesus story in order to create a new character. And so you'll see these Christ figures, and I've got a whole illustration of all of them, but, you know, in all of these, the lead character usually has like a virtuous mother and a divine or royal father. You know, he's born mysteriously and appears to be poor to the outside world. He's got some form of dual identity that's both common and special. I can go on and on. There's a list of attributes of Jesus that appear, and if you start looking at my list of fiction, you'll realize that a lot of the most popular characters in all of literature are not Jesus explicitly, they're Jesus implicitly. They borrow from the Jesus story in order to make their case, in order to make their figure, their character.
And it's not just books. I mean, screenplays, movies. You point out in the book the Jesus film created in 1979, translated into over 1,800 language, viewed by some 8.1 billion people. That's more people than are on the planet. But you're talking about a cumulative period of time since it was produced to the present. That many people have actually watched this. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, because you have Jesus Christ Superstar, The Last Temptation of Christ, The Passion of the Christ, and the list goes on and on. And just seeing that in your book had such an impact on me. It's not something that's lost on me, but just seeing the way it's laid out impacted me so much that I'm doing a new podcast called Hank Unplugged Shorts, where it's just something that comes to my mind. And I said, you know, I was just reading a book called Person of Interest, and I pointed out the significance of Jesus Christ when it comes to not only the literary field, but the field of screenplays and movies.
No doubt about it. The thing about it is that not all of these movies are positive reflections of the true story. A lot of them are pejorative, because this is what the amazing impact, right? You throw that stone in the pond, and it starts to have all those ripples. And some of those ripples are going to be in places that you just don't expect them. You know, they're not always going to be positive. Some people will be believers. They'll say, some people are infuriated by Jesus. They want to mock Jesus. Why do you care about Jesus? You notice this all the time, right? You write a new book from a Christian perspective, and there's going to be a bunch of atheists online who are going to take a club out and try to beat the book down, or beat down anything. But why? Because they sense that there's something in the book that might be edifying to a group they oppose. There's something about Jesus that people either love or hate, right? But he inspires that kind of engagement in a way that no other historical figure has ever caused that kind of engagement. Where you're either, and this is true not just in literary arts, but in the visual arts, it's also true in music. I've got a chapter on that as well, where you'll see that not everyone is singing positive things about Jesus, but you're going to have a hard time finding a pop artist in any genre in the last 150, I mean, if it's pop, country, rap, whatever it is, you're going to have a hard time finding somebody who hasn't been inspired or frustrated or infuriated. He's found some, or she's found some reason to use Jesus in the song, either in a pejorative way or in an honoring way. And that's the kind of impact he has. That's what you'd expect, right? Because, look, I've had people say, well, isn't this true of other fictional characters? Really? You think there's a fictional character that has had this kind of impact on history? You think there's a fictional character in the last year, in the last 10 years, in the last 100 years? Well, let's go 1,000 years into the future and see if we have another break in the common era because of that fictional character. It's not going to happen. There's something about Jesus that reorders all of history that demonstrates he's more than just some copycat savior, some fictional, that no historical character really should have the kind of impact on history that Jesus had. So we've got to figure out a way to account for the impact. And it's remarkable. And people also, Hank, will say, well, yeah, you're talking about Western culture. Really? I try to do my best in the book to show how this is a global phenomenon. Jesus reaches out into every nook and cranny of the world. As a matter of fact, even in those countries where there is some other religious worldview that dominates their culture, well, I guarantee you, if you talk to their religious leaders or their scripture, they've found a way to modify it, merge, or mention Jesus. He has that impact even on other spiritual worldviews, which I talk about in the last chapter. And that's the thing about Jesus. Who could be said to have that? You realize Buddha had a head start. Indra had a head start. Krishna had a head start. They haven't had any kind of impact combined compared to what Jesus has. So how is it with the head start they didn't have that kind of impact? There's something different about Jesus.
No question. And you've already alluded to this, the inspiration that Jesus had with respect to literature, to music. You mentioned the arts and music, but I think that it's important to do a deep dive on this because you think about the paintings and the great painters, the great artists of all time. So many of them are inspired by Jesus Christ. The architecture that's inspired by Jesus Christ. You think of the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, the impact that that had as one of the greatest architectural marvels of all of ancient history. So art and music, they reflect Jesus Christ.
Well, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that is not an entirely Western phenomenon either. So if you were somebody who was researching the history of art, just go get your resources out there. You find any set of resources you like best that describe the history of art, both before Jesus arrives and then after Jesus arrives. And you look at that period in which Jesus existed, was born and died on the cross, rose from the grave, and then you go from that point forward in art history. I want you to pick out every genre of art. I've listed them all in the book. I've got them all in odd circles. You can see how they all fall together, all the way from the antiquity, all the way to Dadaism, to Popism, to all the different forms of the arts. And this is the area that I was involved in before I became a detective. So I love looking at art history. And then I want you just to Google, because I think this is where young people really, I mean, look, Google it. If you don't trust, by the way, Google is not friendly. to Christian worldview and Christian artists. As a matter of fact, a lot of artists have had their Christian identity or their Christian catalog scrubbed because there's a hesitancy to assign anything positive to a Christ follower right now. But even if you just used Google and you said, okay, so who are the top three artists in this genre? Who are the top three impressionist artists? Who are the top three expressionists? Just go through all of those genres and get a list. You can make it the top three if you want to use a couple different sources. Maybe you'll have five. Now search the catalogs for those three to five artists that are at the top of that historical genre of art. And you're going to find that every single one of them have painted, etched, sculpted, or drawn Jesus at some point. Doesn't mean they're all Christians, because they're not. But at some point, they were inspired, and a lot of it is pejorative. It's not necessarily positive, okay? And sometimes it's kind of grotesque. But you will see that the Jesus occupies headspace in artists throughout history in a way that no other historical figure has ever occupied that kind of, and also no other deity. So you will not find, and part of the reason I think for that, Hank, is that Christianity, historically, people groups have modified their image of what Jesus looked like and their image of who Jesus is to contextualize it into their culture. So if you were to look at somebody in Asia who is a Christ follower, who's doing art at some point in history, Jesus will look like the people group that he's being drawn in or painted in. This is true also in Africa. Wherever you are, the artists are reinterpreting. You will not see this for Buddha. So if you look at the artwork of Buddha, you have a hard time pinning down what country it comes from because it all looks so similar. But if you look at the art of Jesus, you'll see that the style, the ethnicity, the cultural references, they're all very specific to the culture in which he's. And because he is malleable in that way artistically, he ends up inspiring a much larger group globally than he would otherwise. And so that's part of why I think Jesus became such an inspiration for so many artists. And I have one illustration in the book that shows you a kind of an A to Z. This is not just limited to the West. This is a global phenomenon.
And another very, very interesting point in the book is where you show that Jesus is, in fact, a person of interest, that the greatest popular musical artists of all time have recorded music about Jesus. And that includes, I'm looking at the list, it's sitting in front of me, John Lennon, Everly Brothers, Simon Garfunkel, Roy Orbison, Muddy Waters, Hank Williams, Frank Sinatra. So here you have the greatest popular artist. I mean, we're not just talking about hymnology. We're talking about popular cultural artists. They've recorded a song about Jesus.
Well, think about it for a second. Where, like, the rich history and tradition of music in the Judeo-Christian worldview starts in synagogues and starts in ancient Judaism and then moves through the hymns that were being sung, so that every meeting in which Christians come together does involve some form of corporate singing, okay? And then at some point, you're singing with people or leading people in song, and now we have this rich tradition. Like, what worldviews can you think of in which someone's going to get up on a stage every week and sing in front of an audience? Okay, that's Christendom. And because of that structure, some of the greatest singers of all time have come out of the church. Now, are they inspiring other cultures? Yes, they are. Because even if you said, well, yeah, but other cultures have, you know, pop singers that, yeah, they do. And largely, they are looking for inspiration to the people who did it first, which is the West, where it's coming out of a Judeo-Christian worldview about music. And it turns out all of the innovative things that brought music into the 21st century are part of that Christian history of music. You know, melody was just translate. It was just passed down verbally. I mean, you didn't have a way to write down melody. When Jesus was on the planet, you would hum a song the way it's supposed to go. And that's because they knew the melody of the song. That was passed as part of the oral tradition. It was not until a Christ follower created musical notation that we were able to write down and start to really advance the cause. You know, even like harmonies. These are things that are included in whatever genre of music you're listening to. It possesses the attributes that directly come out of the history of music as advanced by Christ followers. And so it turns out that wherever you're standing today and whatever you're listening to today, that if you're listening to major and minor scales and harmonies that are being done with multiple instruments, most of them were created by Christ followers, in public, that's publicly accessible, not just to royalty or to the church, well, these are things that are part of a long history of music that is shaped and advanced by Christ followers as part of a larger Judeo-Christian musical worldview. Because let's face it, I mean, we think that even, what does it say in the Gospels? At the Last Supper, Jesus sings a hymn before they leave. So you have this rich tradition of music, and I think a lot of what we see in music, you could, and by the way, you could reconstruct the entire story of Jesus just from the hymns in the first 300 years. Those hymns are still out there. Some religious denominations still sing them, and they are rich, not just in terms of rebuilding the gospel elements, you know, where you can retrace the narrative elements of the gospels, but in reiterating the theological principles, the creeds, they are very rich that way as well. So you can really get a sense of who Jesus was. And I have a list, and a lot of the stuff, as you know, Hank, is in, we had to push it off to a PDF file because our case notes ended up being twice as long as the book. And I didn't want it to be a huge academic adventure, so we've pushed them off to a PDF file. But if you look at the PDF, you'll see that I can tell you every single hymn we used and what data can be mined from those hymns and reconstructed about Jesus.
I love the fact that you keep using that moniker, Christ followers or Jesus followers. You point out in the book that Jesus Christ is a person of interest in that his followers led the modern education revolution, that his followers celebrated the life of the mind. You talk about the invention of the alphabet and how Jesus' followers are largely responsible for advancing literacy around the globe. So the whole education movement and revolution that revolutionized the world traced back to Jesus as a point of interest.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I limited myself in the fallout to just those aspects of culture from which you could, like, you know, in all of our cold cases, we're simply trying to look in places that they didn't look before because they, you know, it maybe didn't happen yet. Maybe it took another 20 years for this thing to happen, so now I can look at it. But often it's just something that maybe they didn't think of 30 years ago that now I'm saying, well, did they ever look over here? No, let's look over there and see what we find. Well, that's what I'm trying to do here. I'm trying to look in the places that most of us don't look for evidence to reconstruct the story of Jesus. And I'm looking not only, did he have a huge impact at this thing? Yes. And from that thing, can I reconstruct the story of Jesus? Yes. Okay, then I included it. So one of the reasons why I included education is that I knew that there were other ancient educational institutions. But most of people who are not Christian, for example, would say that, you know, modern education, we see it through the lens of the modern university. And if you're talking about modern universities as student bodies that are trained by a faculty that is assembled for the purpose of training them and advancing them year by year and eventually awarding them with a diploma when they complete all of the requirements, well, that notion of a modern university comes out of both the monastery systems of Christianity early, then the cathedral schools, and then the first three modern universities that actually did that at Bologna, Paris, and Oxford. Those are founded by Christians. And if you look today at the top 15 universities in the world, I'll let you pick the metric because there's a lot of different agencies that rank the universities. Don't care. I looked at the top 10. It ends up being 15 on three different lists I can put together. They're all founded by Christians. And if you went back and visited those buildings, those campuses, and you opened up their charters to see what they were founded on, what was their basic mission statement, you will find that you can reconstruct the story of Jesus in its entire. As a matter of fact, just from the buildings, you're going to find verses of Scripture. You're also going to find images, because a lot of the first buildings in these ancient universities were chapels, and that's where they were teaching physics and teaching natural sciences, these called natural philosophy back then. So the point is, they were teaching courses in these buildings surrounded by Jesus images, and they're still there. You can reconstruct episode by episode of the Gospels just from the buildings of the top 15 university campuses in the world today. That's the kind of impact that Jesus had on education. Not just that, but all the lower education stuff that we think is so about kindergarten. Well, who started that? That was a Jesus follower. You know, graded levels, or you advance from one grade to the next. Who started that? That was a Christ follower. You know, so much of what you think in terms of elementary and secondary school before you even get to university comes out of a rich teaching tradition of people of the book who, remember, Jesus didn't say, hey, just go out and make them, you know, convert people. He said, make disciples. And making disciples means I got to teach you something to disciple you. You got to know how to read. You got to have an alphabet if you're going to be able to read this book. And it turns out that rich tradition of educating people for the purpose of discipling ended up being the foundation of modern education.
You have an interesting notation in the book where you say that parents have more impact on young Christians than professors do. And oftentimes we look at it in the inverse way, where we say that the modern university is polluting the minds of children. So children come out of churches and they come out of Christian schools, they go to the university, and they quickly lose their faith. But you're talking about the significance of the role of the parent and that being even greater than the role of the professor. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, that's just a sidebar I included because so many of us, you know, I work with high schoolers, and probably my largest audience are high schoolers, and so that's the group I'm really concerned as a youth pastor I was most interested in. But if you look at the polls, yes, it's true. By the time you may say, my kids were Christians when they left here, and then you poll them as they're sophomores or juniors in college and they're no longer following Jesus. But if you ask those sophomores in college, when did you first decide this wasn't true? They will tell you between the ages of 10 and 17. That data is out there, and I record it on our website at coldcasechristianity.com because I want people to see that, yeah, I agree. The universities are more than happy to embrace your non-believing kids into a secular worldview, but don't think for a second that they necessarily got there with strong convictions about Jesus. Most of them have just not expressed to you their lack of conviction about Jesus, and they'll still go to church. They'll still be involved in youth group, but they're already checked out. They don't think it's true, and then they end up in a worldview, in a place rather, a geographic location, where you've got a lot of other people who are like, yeah, join us, because we don't think it's true either. And that's really what you're seeing in the data. And why is that? Because, let's face it, 85% of Christians, maybe in my generation or my dad's generation, became Christians by the time they were 18. Now it's dropped down. There's good research on this that kind of shows it's probably in the 12, 13 range. And why is that? Because you're no longer meeting skepticism for the first time at university. You're meeting skepticism for the first time in your playlist on whatever you're watching on your phone. And, you know, if you Google Jesus, what do you think you're going to get in the first page of responses? Is Christianity true? If you Google that in the first page of responses, what are you going to get? You're going to be dominated by anti-Christian literature, anti-Christian videos. There's nothing else. Even if it's like, oh, no, only 10% are going to be hostile to the Christian worldview. Well, if you're just scrolling down through Google responses, you're going to find that you're going to encounter skepticism. And a lot of people didn't encounter that until they got away from home or away from their church. Now, what I see as a youth pastor is that students walk in with that skepticism. They've already heard all the claims of Bart Ehrman. They've already heard all the claims of all the skeptics. They've already been impacted. They've already seen the movies, you know, and they've all, and not only that, they've been entrenched in a worldview that embraces a non-Christian ethos. So it's like, yeah, I couldn't even hold to a Christian view and enjoy the movies I watch on Netflix. You know, so a lot of this is happening earlier than we ever thought before. And what it means is that if it is happening between 10 and 17, well, those are the years when they're still with us. And it's about, are we paying attention? Are we doing what you talked about at the beginning of this podcast? Are you taking this seriously and realizing we are called to do more than just expose kids to the what's? We have to provide whys for the what's. And so I want to teach my kids what's true, but I want to provide two whys. The first why is, well, why do I think that's true? Why do I think Jesus is who he said he was? Well, I've written two books on this, and I'll tell you that this is why. If you ask me, why do you think Jesus is really existed and is God incarnate? Well, I've written about this in this book. Now, the second why is the one that I also try to write about in this book, and that is, okay, so you told me what is true about Jesus, and you told me why you think it's true. Why should I care? Why should that matter? Okay, great, you're geeked out on it. As an old guy, why should I be geeked out on it at 18? Why should I care? Well, that's because everything that you think matters in life that I thought mattered as an atheist, everything. And for me, the stuff that mattered was, you know, literature and music and art and education and science. Those things matter to most of us. Turns out that you wouldn't be where we are today in 2021 if not for the worldview initiated by Jesus, because it turns out all five of those things stand on the shoulders of Jesus and his followers. So he should matter to you, because it turns out everything that you think does matter to you traces back to Jesus.
What is really interesting about what you just said is that we hear over and over again, follow the science. And one of the prevailing myths in our culture is that Christians are science stoppers, that Christianity is anti-science. There's a quote in your book that caught my attention from Catherine Ferringer. She's a social activist. She's an officer at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who said that we would be 1,500 years ahead if it hadn't been for the church dragging science back by its coattails and burning our best minds at the stake. Now, that is an outrageous statement, but it has a lot of cachet in our culture. There are a lot of people thinking today that Christianity is a science stopper.
Yeah, you'd have to be so ignorant of history to be able to look at that statement and go, oh, wow, you know, because you'd have to believe that somehow Christianity burned the best minds, when in fact, the history of science demonstrates that the best minds were always Jesus followers to begin with. So if I looked through the history of science, you can kind of just start to Google it. How about this? There's lots of books, and I've got them all sitting here on my shelf, but I get it. If you're 15 right now and you're listening to this, or your parents are listening to this, you're probably going to want a source you get to on your phone right now. You're fine. Search on your phone right now for the top scientists or scientific developments of the 5th century BC, or start, you know, 10 centuries in the past BC, and then work your way up through each century. What you're going to discover is that science, as we know it today, explodes after the appearance of Jesus. And what's interesting is it doesn't have to be that way. Jesus could have appeared, you know, somewhere else in the timeline, but I actually have a chart that I can show you. And here's how I got it. I simply said, who are the leading scientists and leading scientific developments in each century? And I charted them. And you'll see bumps in those charts where things take off a little bit, take off here, take off there. And I've tried to figure out, well, why is it taking off there? Of course, for example, you'll see science takes off pretty strongly after universities are in place. The scientific revolution takes place, you know, that's kind of after the printing press, it's after the Protestant Reformation. There's a lot of things that happen that kind of open up different avenues to different countries in Europe. And you might say, well, look, yeah, okay, so did you realize that like 99% of scientists credited with founding the modern sciences during the scientific revolution now, right, of the 16th and 17th century, they're Christians, they're Christ followers. And they are all in Europe. And you think, well, yeah, but everyone in Europe was a Christ follower. Well, yeah, but here's the point. There were more people outside of Europe than there were in Europe. There were bigger people groups in Asia, bigger people groups in Persia, bigger people groups all over the map. Why is it taking off in that relatively small geographic location under Christendom? Because there's something about the worldview inaugurated by Jesus that acts as an igniter for the sciences. And that's why if you make a list, and we did this in the book, and this took forever, by the way, about 950 scientists of notable, I call these tip of the iceberg scientists. So these are the ones that somehow made their way into the history books. They're all Christ followers. And I've made a list of all of the Christ-following scientists that were founders and innovators and inaugurators of their personal scientific discipline, like chemistry or astronomy or biology or whatever it may be, quantum mechanics, whatever it may be, all through history. Well, it turns out these are Christ followers. They are the fathers of the scientific disciplines. They've won more Nobel Prizes in the sciences than any other group. They have been just as strong post-Darwin as they were pre-Darwin. I've got illustrations of that, you can see it. And I've got all the lists in the PDF file and all the denominations, where they come from, you know, where you find them. That took forever to assemble. But the point is, I wanted people to see that the science fathers are dominated by Christ followers. And this is, by the way, Muslims had a huge impact on the sciences. And if you trace the impact that Muslims had on the sciences, you will follow it right up to about the 10th or 11th or 12th century, and then it stops. And it stops largely, and then people have written about this. There's a book called The Closing of the Muslim Mind, where it just talks about what it was largely a theological conviction about the Quran that stopped the impact that Muslims were having in the sciences. Yet there's something about the worldview that was initiated by Jesus that ignited activity in the sciences, and it never slowed down. And so if you look at the list of all of the innovators that we have in the book, I think you'll be pretty blown away by what, and I think that young people need to know that, because there's a sense in which we are perceived as anti-science when most of what we are benefiting from right now from scientific discoveries is because of Christ followers. We have to make an intentional decision not to surrender our historic position of leadership here, because it would not be a Christian worldview mandate. As a matter of fact, the Christian worldview encourages us to explore the natural world around us, because we get to write into that book of nature truths about God that are absolutely in agreement with the special revelation of Scripture, but are seen in the natural world. I mean, we get to explore. Think about, you might be interested in physics, and you just are geeked out in physics. Good for you. But if you think that your exploration of physics is a way for you to worship the God of the universe, you are at a whole different level of commitment, and that's what we see in the sciences.
One of the tired canards that gets pushed out over and over again and captivates the minds of so many people is that Christianity is a science stopper. And here's a classic example. You have a pope, Pope Urban VIII, I believe, who believed in geocentrism at the time that you have Galileo coming out with the notion of heliocentrism. And so the pope is now trying to retard science, the advance of science, which is very, very clear at that time. But he, because he's adhering to Christian principles, wants to stop the work of Galileo.
Well, what's interesting is in Galileo, you know, Tycho Brahe and Copernicus prior to Galileo had proposed these heliocentric solar systems, and had not encountered any of the kind of pushback that Galileo encountered. I mean, if you read about who Galileo was and his style, his demeanor, what he wrote about the Pope, how he approached the Pope, I mean, a lot of what happened to Galileo was based more on personality than on position. I mean, that's really, he was just a very aggressive personality, and he was under house arrest largely because of his relationship problems he had with Pope Urban VIII. But if you remember, Pope Urban VIII, when he held to a geocentric solar system, he was agreeing with the scientific consensus of his time. It wasn't like he held this view. No, from Aristotle all the way through Ptolemy, the people who were thinking about the nature of the solar system and looking for confirmation of this in the stars and the sky, they believed that we were in a geocentric solar system. So what you had here is a battle, which we see in science, a healthy battle, between two scientific views of the solar system. And one ultimately wins, Galileo. Why? Because it is empirically confirmable. This is what we want science to do. Now, the fact that there may have been somebody on either side who says, well, I agree with these scientists rather than with these scientists, well, that's part of where you're going to land. You don't know you're wrong until you know you're wrong. And so a lot of this, now again, did it stop Galileo? Did he say, you know what, he was Catholic. Does he say, you know, Catholicism, I'm done with it? No. He was a Catholic when he died. Did he stop being somebody who believed in God? No. I've quoted him several times on what he said after all of this occurred. None of this he saw as such a tension between his scientific beliefs and his religious beliefs that he needed to abandon his religious beliefs. He saw no problem between these two things coexisting. And so the story of Galileo has kind of become like the poster child for, you know, that people want to throw out there. But really, then you have to ignore every other century, every other decade of science that follows Galileo, in which Galileo looks like small potatoes compared to the number of prominent scientists who claimed a Christ. And by the way, you can reconstruct the story of Jesus by simply reading the personal letters of the most important scientists all the way into the 21st century. So all of these people from the beginning, they wrote about the natural world around them, and they also wrote about their faith and confidence in Jesus, and they repeated the Gospels, they repeated passages of the Gospels in the New Testament, and from their diaries, from their own personal writings, you can reconstruct the entire story of Jesus, including every miracle he ever worked. These miracles never gave any pause to the foremost scientists, even today. They had no problem reconciling the fact that the God of the universe could act in his creation in such a way that is supernatural, that breaks the laws, you know, that basically violates whatever they think they've established. And by the way, these are scientists who have dominated every aspect of the sciences. And I include medicine in that. I could have separated out medicine, right? Because I could have separated out medicine to a chapter, because if you think about it, care for the poor and the underserved has been an area that has been dominated by Christ followers. But I was trying to only pick those aspects of culture from which I could reconstruct physically the story of Jesus. So the prominent physicians and biological sciences, those people are in my chapter on science. But the buildings that they used to use, well, science buildings for the most part get torn down and medical hospitals get torn down and rebuilt much faster than universities do because of the technology issues. And so you don't have some of the first buildings of the earliest hospitals. Those earliest modern hospitals were established by Christ followers, but I can't return to the building to see what they said.
You know, it's very interesting when you think about the advance of science. This never advances against Christian knowledge. It advances in concert with Christian knowledge. In other words, with Christian principles. And so the story doesn't end with geocentrism versus heliocentrism. As our scientific knowledge has advanced, we've learned that heliocentrism itself is false, that our solar system revolves around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and that the Milky Way galaxy is just one of perhaps a trillion galaxies in the visible universe.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's not as though Galileo has the complete picture of what's happening in our universe and how our solar system behaves in our universe. He was just, so again, yeah, have we learned a lot more since Galileo? Of course. And by the way, who has led the charge in that? Mostly Christ followers. The other group that does well in terms of like Nobel Prizes for the sciences, they are disproportionately large, is Jewish scientists. So it's about 60%+ of award winners are Christian. Almost 30% are Jewish. But the number of people who claim and openly claim an atheistic or agnostic worldview is only about 10-15%. It's very small compared to the other groups. And that's interesting to me. As a matter of fact, if you look at the data that's out there, very few of us globally deny the existence of some kind of higher power or God. It's a very small percentage. It may feel like media and social media, for the most part, is sometimes dominated by non-believers, and they can also be some of the loudest people on social media. I feel like, wow, you know, like it's all non-believers. No, to be honest, polling still shows that that's a small group, globally especially. It's a very small group. Even today, people who think about the nature of the world around us end up stepping into metaphysical ideas that begin to parallel theistic principles. I talk about that in one chapter as well, because it seems like we are inclined, it's hard to deny what seem to be reasonable inferences based on evidence. So if you look at the Christian history of science, you'll see that these are people who are trying to make sense of what is God revealing to me in the natural environment. And that sense of devotion is what always guided them.
So what about the Jesus worldview serves as a catalyst for science? I mean, how does Jesus end up igniting a scientific revolution?
Yeah, and so it's hard sometimes to talk about some of this stuff, because I want you to see the charts really show it, where it explodes. But first of all, one of the things that you saw very early is that Jesus followers had a sense, because Jesus established this, that matter was good. In other words, you see a lot of the non-canonical authors have this Gnostic view that matter is somehow evil and to be and is contaminatory. You know, the whole world is actually non-material, and material is maybe an illusion. This idea, and this goes back quite a bit, I mean, Pythagoras held a view that numbers rather than matter were really the kind of the true nature of the universe, right? I mean, and then you've got a number of other ancient thinkers, even Plato, for example, argued that forms, like beauty as a form, were more real than the material objects that imitated the form. So you see a lot of this kind of denial that matter itself. Now think about it. Can you do science in an experimental setting if you think that matter is somehow illusory, or it's not the true nature of reality, is not anything material? Because most of what you're going to be doing in a laboratory is acting on material outcomes, right? You're going to see what happens when I do this. What is the material consequence for this? And that's something you wouldn't be able to do if you hold a view that matter is not worthy of study. Another one, for example, is that if you look at the illustrations of ancient mythologies and read the stories of the ancient mythologies, here's what you're going to find. Most of these ancient gods act like fallen humans, and they are stealing the wives of people on earth. They are involved in debauchery and drunkenness and all kinds of misbehavior. The gods are not always orderly, that's for sure. But Christ followers believe that the whole world was the product of a singular, orderly, rational God. And if you've studied ancient mythologies, you will have a hard time finding cultures that believed in a singular, orderly, rational God. And so it's hard to say you could study the creation of irrational, disorderly beings and find any order that you could trust. It will show you the kind of pattern reflection. You could say, okay, well, if this happens here, it's going to happen over there. That kind of scientific investigation is really dependent upon the idea that God is a singular, orderly, rational God. So if you introduce that idea, now you've got an opportunity to actually study the creation of that God in a singular, orderly, rational way. So there's a number of these kinds of igniters, right, that are different about Christianity. Even the idea that God is distinct from his creation. You know, God is not the creation itself. He is distinct. You know, and also the whole idea of being distinct and irrational is important. Let's say, for example, you're trying to study lightning. Well, how do you just know it's not Zeus, you know, throwing lightning bolts? Or how you're trying to study tidal motions or currents in the ocean. Well, how do you know it's not just Poseidon who's having a bad day? I mean, there are some things that really have to be in place in your theistic worldview before you can make sense of your material world. And these are some of the things that I talk about in the book that just form a foundation from which science is done today.
So you've become a Christian. You started out as an atheist. You do all this examination. You become a follower of Jesus Christ, or a Christ follower, as you call it, or a Jesus follower. But now you believe in myth. You believe in miracles. How's that work?
Well, okay, so I say this all the time to people who are where I was, is that you probably already believe in something extranatural, because if you're somebody who's thought much about cosmology, you believe we're in a universe that came into existence from nothing, because we know that the science tells us, if you trust your science, well, then you know there was no space, time, or matter before the beginning of this universe. We're not in a universe that is infinitely old. We've got several lines of evidence that point to the fact that we are in a finite universe that had a beginning. And if there's a beginning to space, time, and matter, and because there is a beginning, you need a cause. Anything that has a beginning needs a cause. So you're in a universe that has a beginning. That needs a cause. But the cause cannot be made of space, time, and matter, which is what you have been defining as natural. Nature. Well, how we define nature as space, time, matter, acted on by physics and chemistry. But if we're talking about a cause that's outside of space, time, and matter, now we're at least saying this is something extra or supra or supernatural. It's outside of nature. For the first cause of the universe. Now, the only question is that cause personal or impersonal? Now, I think it's actually, there's lots of philosophical reasons why a personal first cause makes more sense for the universe we're living in than an impersonal first cause. But let's just go with the idea, for the sake of argument, if there is a personal first cause for the universe, why would you think then, who could bring everything into existence from nothing? That means the most amazing miracle in all of Scripture is Genesis 1. So you get hung up over small potato miracles like walking on water and feeding 5,000. This is stuff that if I can blink everything into existence from nothing, I can probably do that too. At least hold those with an open hand, because you already believe that there's something outside of nature that caused all this. I'm just suggesting it's a personal being that has since interacted with its creation. And so I'm just asking you to kind of at least hold your skepticism with an open hand.
So the universe itself requires a universe maker. And so if you look at cosmology, you recognize immediately that miracles are necessary to make sense of the universe in which we live. The beginning of the universe, the origin of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe, the origin of life, the natural development of life, all of this requires belief in the supernatural.
Well, look at it this way. I, as a finite human with very limited power, have the ability to deny forces of nature, like gravity, when I catch my pen in my hand. If there is a God of the universe that is a cause of all these things, including the consequence of gravity on space, time, and matter, why would we think he wouldn't have the power to intervene? We do have the power to intervene. We all have this power to intervene in some limited way. We're just suggesting that there is a being out there that does not have the restrictions of power that we have. Why wouldn't it be reasonable he could act in a much less limited way? And so I just felt like, okay, I just have to be honest with myself and say, and it really took me, this is why I wrote a book called God's Crime Scene after his cold case, because let me tell you, that first year was a doozy, and it involved me sitting down and having to wrestle with all these concepts. And I always say afterwards that I had basically a blogger's sense of what was true. So all these chapters I've written in this book, you know, when I did this 25 years ago, I would touch on it, but I wouldn't like write down where I got it from. It wasn't all sourced. There were no case notes. To go back and reconstruct it in a way that is not just a blog, you know, not just a telephone call, but actually is a book you can reference in the future, that was like tough. Okay. But if you ask Susie, every day, from the moment this knucklehead said that Jesus was smart, I got a Bible and I sat every 2 hours before I went to work every day. I was at 3-day weekends because I work at 4:10. So I had 3 days every weekend, and I would spend that time absorbed in this investigation. And she will tell you, I think she must have thought I was crazy. But she started to see the outcome of this. In other words, it's really hard to embrace a claim as big as this without it having an impact on other things in your life, right? This is why Paul in his letters typically starts off making theological proclamations, but at some point it's going to move to the practical. Here's how this should look in your life. And this is really where I was too, right? So it had an outcome, which I did not anticipate. Like, I didn't really think there would be any change at all. I thought I was a good guy, you know? But as she watched that shift, she felt like she was seeing a miracle in front of her eyes. And I think a lot of it probably played into where she ended up landing as well, because she was watching me go through that process. This is one of those claims that will change you, not just change the amount of information you have in your head, but it'll change the way you live your life in front of your kids, in front of your friends, at your job. It's going to change everything. So that's why, you know, be ready. This is not one of those things you add on like, you know, their layer of clothing. You're not putting on a sweater here. You're about to change everything from the ground up. And that's why it takes time, I think, for a lot of us. And be patient. If you'd have met me at 34, you'd have said, there's no way that dude's ever going to be a Christian. No way. I was too antagonistic about Christianity and about Christians I met. A lot of them were like, I was taking them to jail. I watched them do horrific crimes. I was working in a surveillance team, and then I'd take them to jail. They would tell me they were Christians. I'm like, really? So a lot of these folks, I just could not. So I had a lot of stuff I had to take off. This is what this stuff we're talking about, that Christian apologetics does so well. All we're trying to do with books like this is remove the barriers that we've built between ourselves and the gospel. And a lot of times you've built that for yourself, and you've made a decision based on what you think the culture says or what you want out of life, and you have to have that deconstructed so you can see what's true. And a lot of this, what we're doing, is just clearing shrubbery so the path is clearer. And that's a lot of, I had to do that for 8 months, 9 months, and I think it was painful at times. Because, you know, to ask someone to abandon a worldview that they have publicly articulated for years is a big ask.
It is a big ask. And, you know, this is not only about going from atheism to Christianity, but I think in your book, you make the point that you can transition from the religions of the world to Christianity. And in the process, you show the impact of Christ on the religions of the world.
Yeah, I tried to show a map. First of all, it's not just that he has an impact on everything that follows him. Of course, if you are establishing a world religion following Jesus, you're probably going to mention Jesus in some way. You know, in the Baha'i faith, he's a manifestation. In Islam, he's a prophet. I mean, he's got some place in all of these religious worldviews that came after Jesus. But it turns out that many of the religious worldviews that preceded Jesus and then survived into the common era, most of them didn't, but some did, well, they also modified their practices to either mimic what Christians were doing or to include Jesus in some way. So if you're a Buddhist or a Hindu, it turns out that the religious leaders in both of those categories have described Jesus as an enlightened person who becomes like a wise teacher who is consonant with their religious worldview. In other words, there's a place for Jesus within Hinduism. There's a place for Jesus within Buddhism. And that's because they have, you know, identified him as a divine, if you're in Hinduism, or as a wise teacher, as a model, you know, of moral behavior and moral teaching. So they would say that, no, Jesus is very much like other leaders or manifestations or persons within that religious tradition. In other words, everyone hat tips Jesus. At some point, the other world religions, and so if you're a member of those religions and you're in a part of the world where there are no Christians, but you're in Hinduism, well, if they've ever heard about Jesus from their leaders and the global leaders in these categories, and I quote them in the book, have all made room for Jesus. At the same time, Jesus does not make room for anybody else. That's interesting, right? Like the other leaders and people groups who hold a religious worldview will accommodate Jesus in some way, but Jesus does not accommodate them in any way. He says, but I'm the only way to the Father. No one gets there except through me. So that's a very interesting, and I thought, well, okay, that's a bold claim and kind of intolerant, or it might just be that, by the way, I might have five suspects in a case. One of these guys is going to emerge as unique. The other five or four, they're going to have some things in common that kind of rule them out. But this one guy, he's going to have a unique set of features, a unique set of issues with the victim, a unique set of circumstances that identify him because he is not like the others. And that ends up being my true suspect. And there's a sense in which Jesus is like that, right? He is not going to accommodate others. Every other system is you attain the next level of what you hope for in life or in the next life. You attain through your good works, through something you do. Jesus is the one oddball that stands out and says, no, actually, it's what we do, what I did for you. That is. So it's a very different kind of a system. And it stands out in such a unique way that he becomes like that suspect who doesn't match the others. So either this is just a complete train wreck of an idea, or he stands out uniquely because he is the one true story about God, the one true explanation about God compared to all the other. Back to what C.S. Lewis said, he is the true myth from the mind of God rather than the false myths from the mind of men.
Your postscript, I want to talk about that as we end this podcast. In the postscript, you say that the unlikeliest of suspects is Jesus. He is unlikely as a person of interest. And you say that because he was born in a tiny, irrelevant town. He was raised in another small village. He had to walk from place to place. He never traveled more than 200 miles from the town where he was born. No social media platform. No podcast audience. No clever video, no website. He never held a political office, never ruled a nation, never led an army, and he never authored a book. And here you have Jesus as a person of interest who had a greater impact on history than anyone. And every reconstruction of the Jesus story from literature, art, music, education, science describes Jesus Christ really at the end of the day as God incarnate. How is it possible that you have a person of interest that comes from that kind of humble orientation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. As a matter of fact, I started to think about if I didn't know what flipped the switch on the Common Era. I just knew that, hey, something happens, and we'll start counting time right here. Well, okay, let's go back to the first century. Look at every world leader. I have a list of them. You won't even recognize half those names. Together, those world leaders did not have an impact on history that Jesus had. Look at every religious leader or deity that was worshipped at that time. Together, they don't have the kind of impact that Jesus did. Look at every world leader that's ever lived. I have all the top ones. And you answer me, who on this list of world leaders from the beginning of time to now has ever had the kind of impact that this dude had? I mean, a list of all of the people who over the years have claimed to be the Jewish Messiah. And there are a number of those. By the way, nobody knows those names because they aren't the Jewish Messiah. But you have to see them to realize that it's just odd to me that this is the guy that changes everything, that has that kind of impact. And that to me has got to at least be a sense that there's no way that an average guy, another historical figure, could have that kind of. Now, if on the other hand, the statements he made about himself, the statements the New Testament make about his deity, if those are true, well, this would perfectly explain the kind of impact he's had. Look, no human should have this kind of impact, but if God enters into his creation, you would expect this kind of impact. And that's exactly the kind of impact we see. So I do think, in a sense, that there's, and look, it's not as though we don't have evidence from a crime scene, because we do have the Gospels. We do have the New Testament. But I'm just talking about acting as though those things don't exist. There is enough reason to believe Jesus is who he said he was, just from all the stuff outside the crime scene. But lucky for us, we do have all of the information that's inside the crime scene. And when you put those two things together, You have to ask yourself, why in the world are you still on the outside looking in? Why? It's got to be something other. Most people don't even know this level of evidence exists as they are rejecting claims about Jesus. It's not about the evidence. Now, I get it. For some of us, we have to clear debris. We have to kind of, like when I was listening to you in the car, and where we started, when I was listening to you in the car, and I was not a believer yet, and I was thinking, oh, this guy is modeling something. Like, he seems to believe it's true. Like, that pastor, like, said this thing about Jesus as though it was like, duh. And it provoked me to start to remove the barriers that I had built up. And so a lot of us just have to know that, hey, if you're saying there's not enough good reason to believe this is true, well, that's not the case. There's something else keeping you out. Sometimes I think we have to go through the evidence for people so we can highlight what it really is that's keeping them out. So you could say, well, look, if there's something else that's keeping them out, we need to focus on that thing. You won't even get to that thing if you can't first show them that this is not the issue. There's more than enough reason to believe this is true.
Well, I'll tell you, this has been a very enlightening podcast, and the book is absolutely fabulous. I mean, it's a very readable book. It's an interesting book. It's a book that you not only read, but a book that you can remember because of the illustrations. It is a very unique way of doing apologetics. And I have to add this in ending the podcast. I started by saying that apologetics is basic training for every Christian. And Person of Interest, the book, is apologetics at its best. Apologetics is necessary for the preservation of the faith. And I think by reading this book and getting this book into the hands of a lot of people, you're part of the process of preserving the faith once for all delivered to the saints. And this is particularly necessary at this stage in Western civilization. Chuck Colson, my good friend, before he died, used to tell me over and over again, Hank, we cannot lose Western civilization. But it is, as I speak, slipping over the edge into the abyss. Books like this make a difference. And then, as I said at the beginning, apologetics is necessary for the cultural relevance of the church. So instead of merely pontificating assertions, we are commanded to provide defensible arguments. And this book does that with gentleness, respect, and great excellence. So it is a resource that I hope all of our podcast listeners will take, absorb, and use to make a difference while there is yet time. J. Warner Wallace, thank you so much for your contributions. You have made such a difference as you have transitioned from a cold case detective to one of the great apologists in the Christian world.
Thank you so much. It means so much to me, Hank, coming from you, who has always served as an inspiration for me from the very beginning. So I just thank you again.
Well, my pleasure. And again, you can get the book, Person of Interest, Why Jesus Matters in a World That Rejects the Bible, on the web at equip.org. If you stand with me shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth, we'll send you a copy of Person of Interest. My thanks again to J. Warner Wallace for his writing and for the difference he's making while there is yet time. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Look forward to seeing you next time with more.